I haven't partaken in any of the French lessons. I'm looking forward to the Benin accent coming out in the French. I thought the Cork accent was tough, but Conor Ryan's will take it to a whole new level.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Ladbrokes. Passionate about sport.
It's gone to the short side. Oh, it's not gone to the short side. It's gone to the try line. And Colin Murray.
I don't think we met before, but I'm the referee on this field, not you.
Hi, Rob. Zeeb's here. Just want to discuss the captaincy next.
He's calling.
When Ringrose comes through. Oh, that is brilliant from Ringrose. Ringrose is going here. What a score.
Welcome back to a new season at the Hard Yards. I have Kev McLaughlin and Pat McCarry in studio. Morning.
Hey.
And we have Ronan O'Gara and Ian Madigan on the line from Paris and Bristol, respectively. Raj, how are you?
Great. And yourself?
I'm pretty good. Ian, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks so much for having me on.
How is, Raj, we'll go with you first. How is pre-season going? Because you're kicking off Saturday.
Yeah, it's great, I suppose it's probably the longest building we've ever had in French rugby, which is about 6-7 weeks. Last year was 4 days and a game on the fifth day, imagine. And this year it's been good, but a lot of injuries for some reason, and also it's been, I suppose, really tiring from a coaching point of view, because it's a time where you can get an intense amount of work done with the players. So I found that I've been tired. I need to manage my energy better in that regard, but it's been hugely interesting. You actually get genuine coaching, because if you play Saturday, an awful lot of the week from Wednesday on would be rest and kind of just mental preparation for the players. But now every day you can coach, and that's I suppose the thing that I love about it, the interaction with the players.
Have you found that you're bringing anything in now from the your experience in Irish camp?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, I think obviously the two lads would know Joe a lot better than I would, but I was just fascinated with his energy, his enthusiasm, his drive every day, just from 7 in the morning till 10 at night. And you won't ever, I think, repeat that in a club setup, but I think just the emphasis he puts on certain, I suppose, key values, that's what really interested me, and how you have to drive it, because players learn differently and learn in different fashions and different forms. And I was just fascinated to see some people are probably better with a paper and pen, and other people actually need to see it out in the pitch, actually walking through it and then running through it to learn. So if you learn it and you're secure in your head, I think then you can add aggression and attitude and running lines. So for me it was a great experience.
So Ian, that's the coach's view of how pre-season is going. How's the player's view?
Yeah, it's obviously, some players dread it, you know, and most of the guys are coming back in poor condition that are going to have to be doing, you know, the fat camp and you know, extra sessions on Saturday. But what I found is, you know, as my career's kind of gone on, you begin to start looking forward to pre-season, and it's now an opportunity to iron out any injuries you're carrying from the previous season, and it gives you, you know, as Roy said, you know, bigger windows to go to improve your skills, because you don't have games for, you know, 6-7 weeks, so you can train hard, you know, throughout the week. And you know, a lot of clubs now, they give you the weekend off, so you can, you know, still make something of your weekend, which is nice. But it's been a good pre-season here. It's been more similar to what I would have been used to in Leinster, in the sense that there's more structure around it, more consistency. Whereas I found in France, you know, you'd be arriving in every day and you wouldn't really know what they were going to throw at you. So it's been nice being back in that kind of more structured system. I found it's probably been easier to commit to, because, you know, you're only going to be on the pitch for maybe an hour or 45 minutes, whereas in France it could be, you know, over 2 hours. It's very hard to commit 100% when you're not really sure how long you're going to be out there, because you've got to keep a bit of energy left in the tank.
Was that a big shock to the system when you're moving from a very structured environment into something that, well, A, would have been an unknown for you going over there, and B, you know, you're finding it and you might not have liked it? You know, what do you do in that position? Do you just go with the flow, or can you try and influence that in any way as a player?
Yeah, I think initially you've got to go with the flow. You know, you're a new player in a new club, so you don't want to be coming over being like, oh, this is how we did it here, this is how we did it there. There's more than one way of being successful. And I suppose when I first arrived over in France, there were certain things that I probably knew deep down that they weren't doing right, and then other things that, you know, that they were doing very well. So you've just got to kind of choose your battles, I suppose, and, you know, pick the ones that really matter to you and that you think are going to make a big difference. It was tough. It was, you know, during my time in Leinster, I knew it was a special place, and like the structures they have in place there and the people they have working in the club, like from the S&C staff through to, you know, the physio, medical, even like the people who are working in the ticket sales, and obviously the coaches and the players. It's a pretty special group there, and because that's all I knew, I probably thought that, you know, every other club in Europe was like that, whereas the reality is they're not. So you just have to, you know, adjust and adapt to that. And it was hard at times, but it was also a very refreshing experiencing a new club.
Bring Kev in here. Kev, were you ever in fat camp as part of pre-season, or were you a good boy?
I was, unfortunately. I went through that invincible stage where I was like, I can eat whatever I want, I'm never going to get fat. And then around the age of 24, 25, it happened. I got fat over the summer. I had one kebab too many on holidays, and I came back and like there was an explosion in my belly over the course of the 4 weeks, and I found myself in fat camp doing like real shameful, like at one stage, one of the things we did when we went on tour, Jason Cowman was the head of S&C at the time, the fat boys had to just go for a walk. It was like the walk of shame. So like at 6:30 a.m. from our hotel in France, we had to just go out and walk around the square for about an hour, like fasted walk. And it was real shameful stuff.
Past KFCs and McDonald's.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep going.
They're wafting the smell of croissants across us. Like, yeah, exactly. Like when you're out with the likes of Rossi and stuff, you're kind of questioning yourself a bit. So luckily I never found myself in fat camp again. But like pre-season for me, I was like, Matt's talking about some people hate it, some people love it, I got to really enjoy it, particularly in the later years of my career. It's that kind of 10 to 12 weeks of where you're doing 12 or 13 sessions a week, and everything's about like pushing you forward and doing a lot of stuff you can't do during the season. And our S&C coaches used to talk about putting money in the bank for the season, that you can draw on, reserves you can draw on later in the season. It was a nice way to talk about it. It's like fueling up the tank for the season. And then throughout the season, it was just about maintenance and maintaining what you'd built, and then you go again the following pre-season, which is great. I'll never forget the first proper pre-season I did was when Czechs came to Leinster. Mads, you'll probably remember this as well. His mandate was to come in and toughen us up, because we'd had Declan Kidney, Gary Eller, the previous coaches, and there was a feeling we weren't mentally tough enough. So he threw all science out the window and he just goes, we're going to train harder than we've ever trained before. We were doing six running sessions a week. Each of them was about an hour long. We used to go up to Cliny Hill on Saturday mornings. I remember that drive out to Cliny Hill on a Saturday morning, absolutely dreading it. And he absolutely beasted us to the point where guys were on their hands and knees by the end of preseason. All it was him watching to see who buckled and who looked weak and who was kind of hanging in there. And it was just an assessment of who was going to be mentally strong enough to last the Leinster. And he used those pre-seasons to kind of weed people out to a certain extent. It was pretty horrible at the time, but I think it was a good test for us. And then Joe came in and he brought in a different level to pre-season. Like Mads is talking about the long sessions versus the short sessions. Joe used to do the shortest incredibly like intense drills, like rugby related drills, for conditioning, and then allow the S&C coaches to do their job. And I just remember pre-season with Joe before the 2013 season was the best I've ever felt, like, yeah, in terms of the training we'd done. And if you get a pre-season right, it can be an unbelievable launch pad for the season.
Raj, when you listen to Ian talking about his experience going to France and just a different style of pre-season, the lack of structure, did you go through a similar experience when you went out there, from your playing days with Munster, with Ireland, to arriving in a French club setup?
Yeah, well, I'm here 4 years, fifth season, so I've seen a lot, Andy, to be fair, you know. And I think we're a lot further down the road than we were 4 years ago as a club, but I suppose the way it is that it's driven by French people with French ideas, and that's the way it is in terms of you have three senior management who are French, three strength and conditioners in our club are strength, and the medical team is fully French. So it's in a French league, so it's going to be French, and a lot of their thinking is based on their thinking. So there are definitely areas to improve. I think it would be a fascinating place to kind of get an all-international management team coupled with a few French coaches. I think the potential to do something would be huge in France if you could manage to do that. But I think it's only World Cup winners really that get that opportunity at the minute, in terms of, you know, Jake White was in there, Joe Schmidt was an assistant for Ancotter now at Montpellier. I think they're the team to watch this season. But that would be the ultimate goal, I think. It's just a mix. I think the international flavour with the French element to it, because you have to respect their culture and their environment. And I understand exactly all the grievances Ian is talking about, because it's a very average league for a long time, but then come playoff time, I think it's the best championship in the world for that quarter-final, semi-final, final of the Bouclier. I think the game goes to a whole new level in terms of just, I would say probably, maybe not intensity, but just I would say just the whole ambience of the whole country. It's gripped by the top 14 semi-final and final. It doesn't happen for Champions Cup, unfortunately, but there are massive areas that we could do 10 podcasts on in terms of this. But it's a hugely interesting topic, and you know, you look at all the coaches from around the world that have come over to France and tried to crack it, but a lot of them have been run out of the place.
Rog, how much of it do you think is down to budgets? I mean, you look at teams like Leinster and Munster who have managed to succeed in Europe against teams that have 5-6 times their budget. And I think part of Irish culture, obviously, but it's also part of what like the provinces have had to do. They knew they had to find an edge somewhere, and they weren't going to do it by bringing in the best players in Europe, like the likes of Toulon and Toulouse and Racing Cannes. You know, do you think maybe the massive budgets encourage bad habits, and that maybe we don't need to work on our focus and building something special here because we can bring in unbelievable players, or is it purely a French thing?
I would turn that around, and I would probably, from an outsider looking back at Ireland, just I think how incredibly well driven the players are, created by their own group. I would like to think that you know, you can look back at the guys from John Hayes to Quinny to Axel to Halvey to hopefully Strings, myself, that kind of generation drove that. You look at all the local Leinster players from your time, how he drove that to a whole new level. Some could say that there was average players completely over excelling, but because he played for each other, he maximised absolutely everything. The example would be in France, okay? If you sign a player and he becomes overweight, it becomes acceptable. Okay, if that was in Ireland, you would have the senior players in that club doing fitness with him, getting the best out of him, managing his lifestyle to make sure he drops the weight. If in France, it's not, it's just viewed upon as accepted. It's a small thing, but yet it's a massive thing, because you could have a player that's 10 kgs overweight, punishing the team, but isn't too driven to shift the weight. What would happen in Ireland would be that he would absolutely train hard, eat well, live well. He'd get a 6-week window period. If he's playing ball with his teammates, the lads will do everything for him. But if he's taking the piss out of them, he'll be dropped and he'll be sent home. You know, I think that would be my reading of it. I just think that the values in Irish rugby are only seen, and Mads has said it, when you leave it. Because when you're there, you think it's really tough and it's hard being an impact sub, but it's an unbelievable squad environment, be it obviously I'll be friendly with a lot of Leinster guys, but in Munster, in Irish camp, I think it's something that we as Irish people are very good at. I think we're unbelievably hard working and driven, and you know, you look in France, and that's the great thing about Andreas and Sustain here. You have the New Zealand culture, the Australian culture, the South African culture, the Georgian culture, the Fijian culture, the Anglo-Saxon culture, so the Argentinian culture. So you get to see everything, and you get, after 4 years, you kind of get to see the mental side of it too. And I just think there's great learnings in that regard to sometimes just as Irish we don't back ourselves enough would be the only thing I've taken out of it.
The Ian, you're now on to another step of the journey, I suppose. How did the signing for Bristol actually come about?
Basically, once Pat agreed to come over to Bristol, he has he's with the same company that I'm with, eSportif, and he spoke to Ryan Consul about it and asked would I be interested in coming over. And at the time, I was out of favour in Bordeaux, and you know, wanting you know, probably a more structured environment. So I had a few conversations with Pat, and a few conversations with people in Bristol, and basically you know, offered me to come over and wanted me to be part of what they're building over here. You know, they've made it clear with some of the big signings they've made, and with bringing over, you know, the strength and conditioning staff Pat had in Connacht, and the, you know, very good medical team here, two Irish lads, Rory Murray is from Northern Ireland, another guy, Owen from Dublin. It's just the whole package really on that side of things. So really appealed to me, and they offered me a 3-year deal, so it was, you know, good security at this stage in my career. And I then had to speak to Bordeaux about it, because I was supposed to be over there for 2 years, and then just came to an agreement with them to release me out of the second year of my deal, and was able to come over then. So it's been good. I haven't really looked back since. I still really enjoyed my time over in France, and it's not a decision that I regret doing. You know, I was able to meet some great people, and you know, seeing how the French culture works, and playing in a different competition, and being able to draw off the likes of, you know, Adam Ashley Cooper and some senior guys like that who've great international experience. It definitely grew me as a person as well. You know, I think in Leinster and Dublin, you know, you're in your comfort zone. Everything's laid on to you in the club. You know, your teammates are guys that you've come to school with, or you've played underage stuff with, or you've known for, you know, 4 or 5, you know, 7, 8 years. You know, you're playing in the same competition each year. You kind of have a fair idea of what other teams are going to bring, and you know, you know, going into pre-season roughly what's involved. And I was kind of ready to, you know, to challenge myself and experience something new and something different. So, you know, it's definitely grown me, I think, as a person as well.
Yeah, Pat wanted to come in there.
Yeah. Ian, was it, I suppose when it looked like you were signing for them, it looked odds on that Bristol were going to get themselves relegated. So was that a kind of completely, you know, different challenge to take on? Was it something that you discussed with Pat as well? How kind of, what this next season is going to entail?
No, it wasn't honestly a conversation I had with Pat. Like, he was, you know, saying to me that, you know, that it was a long term thing. At the time, it was kind of 50-50. Like, I think themselves and Ulster were only 2 or 3 points apart, so I was still hoping that they were going to stay up. But
yeah, you've got Duncan O'Callaghan to thank for that one, all right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, he's still managing to screw over the Leinster boys, but yeah, no, like the thing is with Bristol, like, it does give us more time to get everything right. Like, if Pat had came over and we'd stayed up in the Premiership last year, you know, it would have been a bit of a rush job trying to get, you know, his whole system across And, you know, getting everyone buying into it and building, you know, the culture that he wants to instill in the team in a period of, you know, 5 or 6 weeks or in preseason. And then, you know, you've got to be very ready for game one. And that is one of the differences, I think, with France and the UK, in the sense that you've got to really be ready on, you know, game one, two, three to hit the ground running. You can't afford to, you know, for example, in the top 14, if you lost your first two home games, you'd probably find the coach is going to get sacked. So that gives you, you know, a very much a short-term focus in preseason. You want to have your players fully fit and game ready for game one. Whereas with the Pro 12, I know at Leinster, you know, you're not really looking to peak for the first game of the Pro 12. You're looking to peak for the first European game. So you're going to have some international guys coming back, you know, in maybe game two, game three, game four of the league. You're going to have some guys who you're not going to rush back. You might have had surgery during the summer, or, you know, picked up a, you know, an injury during preseason that you don't want to rush back. And you're also trying to work in pre-season on building something like Kev said, you know, building something that's going to sustain you for the whole year, that it's not going to have you peak and then, you know, come post-Christmas you're going to fall off a cliff and you're going to be feeling lethargic and low on energy. Whereas, you know, the teams in France and the UK, they, you know, they have to really hit the ground running, or else you're going to end up like a side like Grenoble last year that got off to a slow start, and then teams will start targeting them when they're playing away from home, sending their best side, you know, to go and beat them. And, you know, you end up on a very slippery slope there, you know. So, you know, coming back to what we're trying to build in Bristol, it means with sustaining the championship this year that we can, you know, build it gradually through preseason. Like, you know, I'm sure that Pat hasn't shown all his cards to the team yet, but he's been able to do that because he wants to build it slowly and make sure it's going to be something that's sustainable and going to stand us in good stead over the next few years.
Mads, you were there when Joe came into Leinster, obviously, and he went about trying to build something special. Like you say, he didn't get off to an amazing start. I think we lost our first four games under him, but he was planning long term all along, and he knew there was the talent there to build something special in Leinster. Do you get the feeling like Pat and Joe come to the same school in New Zealand? I think they've worked quite closely together in the past. Do you get the feeling Pat's doing something similar and has a similar style to Joe, or what's that been like so far?
Yeah, they're similar in lots of ways and very different in other ways. You know, the ways that they'd be similar, like their attention to detail is incredible. You know, we use the drone in training, and you know, Pat must watch the training footage 30 times because he literally, it seems like he's man marking everyone and seeing, you know, which guys are working hard for him, which guys aren't, who's out of position. He was getting off the ground quickly, like all that kind of stuff that Joe Schmidt would have driven. Like, I remember when Joe came in, like the video analysis were worked off their feet because he wanted to measure so many different things for every player. And you know, Pat is no different to that. He's, you know, very consistent, like similar to Joe. You know, I don't know how much these guys sleep, but like Pat seems to be, you know, up at 5-6 o'clock every morning, and you know, he's sending out WhatsApps at 11 or 12 o'clock at night. So kind of reminds me a bit of Joe's, you know, incredible work ethic.
That sounds like my work ethic as well.
Very consistent, Kev. Like, I'm sure you remember with Joe, like, you know, if, let's say, you know, someone dropped a pass, he'd say, oh, good players take those. Or if it was something small, like, you know, setting early in defence, setting early in attack, you find with other coaches, like, on week three, week four, month three, month four, that they'll just be like, oh, I'll let that one go. Whereas Pat and Joe will say it every single time, regardless of what player it is, and that, you know, that really instills, I think, good culture and good habits, you know, in a team.
In terms of culture, Roger, go back to you. How is Dunnock Ryan settling in over there? And I want to know how his French lessons are going.
He's settling in well, I think. I suppose he's very happy to make the change. It was 100% his decision, so it's a it wasn't a contractual issue, I don't think. I think he just wanted a lifestyle change. So probably an important point for people at home to understand that he wanted to do it. So if he wants to do something, he's going to embrace his new challenge. But he's struggling with a neck injury, and I think his body is fairly battered from taking a pounding over the last number of years. So at the minute, he's kind of he's been managed. I don't think he'll feature, certainly not in game one this weekend. But he has a good attitude. I haven't partaken in any of the French lessons. I'm looking forward to the Benin accent coming out in the French. I thought the Cork accent was tough, but Conor Ryan's will take it to a whole new level. But he's up for it. He's a closet nerd, you know. I think he's studying away, and he's on top of things. But it's one of the things, and Ian will know, if you can't get your point across, it's very, very frustrating, be it as a player or a coach. And the game's hard enough in one language, and then when you have the translating between French and English, and then the inter-discussions, and one word can lose the discussion or change it or change your perception of what it is, it becomes very frustrating. So I think you have to have a basic level of French, and he's keen to get that as quickly as possible.
Now, we need to go through some of the news roundup for the summer, because we did take a little break past the Women's Rugby World Cup. We kind of thought we'd be spending a little more time on this, but Ireland, the performance on the pitch was not what we wanted it to be.
Yeah, from the first game, even against Australia, they struggled against an Australian team. I think I'd only played three times. Five times since the last World Cup. So that's five games in 3 years. And it was a big Australian team they put out there, but they struggled to get over the line against them. It was a pretty good, brave performance, because they were on the back foot for most of it, but got a win out of it. But then we're poor against Japan. And then just taking no real form into it against a French side that, Ireland just made them look amazing on the day. Like, France are very good, but you see what England did to them. They kind of they played them at arm's length and put them away. So it's very disappointing, because the enthusiasm was there. I know some media outlets criticise the setup, but I liked it out in UCD. It was kind of maybe it was because it was a bit amateur, you know. Like, it was, but it was fun to go out there.
I was out there. I thought it was a good. It felt like a sevens tournament.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean that in a very good way. It was two grand. For anyone who wasn't out there, there was two small stadiums. There was a fan zone in the middle. You bought your ticket for the stadium for the day. You could wander around. It was a good environment.
Yeah, yeah. So like all that was nice. And then heading up the road to Belfast to the Kingspan Stadium was the plan. But Ireland didn't plan on playing a fifth place semi final to get into it, you know, to get fifth place. So and then the wheels fell off in that final game. And it was very. It was interesting to see that a lot of the older guard, the girls that kind of helped them win the Grand Slam a good few years back were the ones that stepped up again. So there was no real, apart from maybe Nicole Cronin and Cliona Maloney, who was hooker, like no one else kind of really pushing through. Like, you still needed someone like Sophie Spence, who didn't look 100% fit, to come off the bench and kind of save the day on a couple of occasions. So real shame to kind of see how that went, because you know things were building nicely, and they just looked, the style of play was pretty bland, one out runners and stuff like that, and no real invention in the back line, and moves just like maybe any kind of move they might have planned would just not come off. Runners would be shooting at the wrong time, and it was a bit of a mess. Like, and even from talking to a few of the players now, it's funny that they would talk things up even before the tournament, but then maybe off the record you'd hear stuff like that the planning and preparation was a mess, and they weren't happy going into it as well. And the likes of England, New Zealand and Canada were all down in New Zealand during the Lions Tour playing each other, and Ireland were playing against Japan twice, and they weren't getting prepared properly. Like, even if they could have played a France or USA or got another decent side over to help them warm up, and they were caught cold, and it showed, I think.
Another thing that's happening that maybe people mightn't have picked up is that we've had a raft of law changes. Raj, is this something you've had to deal with in the pre-season?
Yeah, it'll be very interesting.
What's the biggest impact you're looking at so far? Is it the ruck change?
No, well, for me, I find the biggest one is the on the exit, so that the blocking players have to be bound and you can't form a straight line. So essentially what you have to do is just to build a train in terms of when the nine is trying to box kick, we say, from inside of 22 or on the 22 or outside it. So basically any of the forwards that are, you know, I mean, taking up blocking lines, they can't just spread across the line. Now it has to be kind of one in front of the other and bound, and you have to make the ruck longer. But geez, try telling that to a forward who's got himself off the ground after four or five phases, and he's sucking diesel and he has to bind on. It'll be, you know what I mean, I think it opens more a window for blowing a penalty every time, depending on the perception of the referee. So it's difficult, because every twice a year now you nearly have minimum four rule changes coming in, or law changes, and it's difficult, you know. I think the good one, as you said, yeah, is maybe around the tackle area and the ruck and having to come through the gate. That takes a lot of the it takes a lot of the good elements of certain forwards out of it, but it makes it really hard for the defending team at times to slow down the opposition's ball.
We might dive into this.
Consistency on this, you know.
Yeah, we'll dive into this, I think, a bit more in a future show. But one thing, we'll one takeaway, yeah, and see how they pan out. But the Italy tactic will no longer be able to happen, which is, it's a bit of a shame. But we have seen Bundiaki and Tyler Blaendell in Irish camp. They become eligible, I think, in October this year. So Bundy can play in the autumn.
And then Blaendell, yeah, he can play for the Six Nations, yeah.
Yeah, in January, yeah. Okay, I'm going to open the floor.
I'm happy to see it, yeah. Especially, let's say, with Bundy, like the likes of maybe Henshaw's not going to be back in time and Ringrose isn't going to be back in time. So we might get a couple of games here in the November series. And if you can get the same Bundiaki that you got the season they won the league, that can only be good things for Ireland. Like, so Tiernan O'Halloran, we were talking to him yesterday at the Pro 14 launch, and he was saying he absolutely loved it, but he's got double the homework now from Kieran Keane and Joe Schmidt. And he said almost when it comes to Schmidt, it's triple the homework. He said you have 24 hours to learn it under Schmidt or you're in trouble already.
Tiernan, these are good problems to have.
Yeah.
Kev, what do you think? How do you feel with the lads joining in? Good options to have, but it does, we'll always talk about the residency debate.
Yeah, from an Irish perspective, like it's more options, and I think, you know, Joe will be delighted to have those options. But, you know, it doesn't always sit right with me, perfectly honest. I think I'm just not sure it's the best way, the best thing for world rugby. But there are the rules, and everyone else is taking advantage of it, so why shouldn't we? And, you know, these guys have been in Ireland for a few years now. They know what Irish rugby is about. They know what the provincial rugby is about. And they're going to now, potentially put on green shirts. Which, again, is it an overall positive for Irish rugby? I'm not sure. But it's definitely changing the landscape. I think the new residency rule, 5 years, is definitely moving in the right direction for me.
Yeah, we don't see it move in for a while, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, it's not something I feel massively comfortable with, but...
Ian, you've obviously got some skin on the game here. So how do you feel about this? Do you look at these kind of squads these days when you see players coming in?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Still keep a close eye on it all. I suppose, like, similar to what Kev said, you know, like the two guys, if they've come over from what I've heard from Bundy and Tyler, you know, they've fitted in really well, and you know, they've bought in massively to the culture in Connacht and Munster, and you know, all they can do really is just play the hand that they've been dealt, and you know, they're operating within the rules of the game, and you know, the best opportunity that they felt they had at the time was to come over to Ireland and to fit into, you know, Munster or Connacht and give it their all with their province, and then you know, have the opportunity of representing Ireland. So, you know, good on the two lads on you know, making best with the hand that they were dealt in that sense. And you know, look, the Irish team, it's still going to be picked on merit. So, you know, on a personal note, I just focus on myself and getting, you know, making sure that I'm playing as well as I can play, to hopefully be an option for Joe over here. And I'm not going to be worrying what you know, what other lads are doing. I'm just about getting myself in the best shape and finding form as best I can, really. Yeah, look, it's always going to be one of those ones that's going to be topical enough.
Out of interest, just before we go, did you have a word with Joe before you decided to go to Bristol? Was that part of your equation?
Yeah, I had a chat with Joe. I've kept in contact with Joe since I've moved away. Like, I was very lucky to have him coach me in Leinster for a few years, for, you know, 3 or 4 years, and to be part of the Ireland setup for a similar length of time. So, you know, off the back of that, like, you know, Joe's been, you know, a great kind of mentor and coach for me. So, I'd still keep in contact with him and you know, massively respect his opinion and his advice on my game. So, no, I had a conversation with Joe about it, but, you know, at the time it was probably a tough fit to get back into, you know, one of the other Irish provinces. And you know, in the end, I just waited up with, you know, with my family and made the decision on what I thought was the best rugby decision for me at the time.
Good stuff. The boys will be back later answering your Twitter questions, but up next we'll find out how exactly two South African franchises have ended up playing in what's now the Pro 14.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Ladbrokes, passionate about sport.
You're very welcome back to the Hard Yards. As you know, the Pro 12 has become the Pro 14 this season with the addition of the Cheetahs and the Southern Kings. You might be wondering how that happened. We have Lloyd Bernard from Sport 24 in South Africa on the line to help tell the story. Lloyd, hello.
Hi.
How did this come about? Super Rugby is obviously having its trouble navigating expansion and perhaps weaknesses in certain markets, but how have we ended up with two South African sides playing in the Northern Hemisphere League?
I think you guys should tell us. Look, I mean, like you said, Super Rugby had its challenges, you know, with the expansion over the last two seasons and with 18 teams. It's been difficult. It's been difficult for the average spectator to follow the tournament in terms of league standings. It's been difficult in terms of player depth, particularly in South Africa and Australia, in terms of just having weaker franchises because we have more of them. And I think Sands obviously just got to a point where, you know, they needed to do something. And going back to 15 sides was considered the answer. Obviously, the Japanese and Argentinian markets were not, you know, Sands, I didn't want to interfere with those because it's considered important to take the game there. And Australia and South Africa were the logical countries to kill. And when looking at the six franchises and trying to get it down to four in South Africa, you know, the Cheetahs and the Kings were really the only two options given the financial security and the history and tradition of the other four. So it was tough on them, and certainly both of those franchises offered a lot in Super Rugby, particularly this season and particularly in the case of the Kings. And yeah, certainly what seemed a tough call and has worked out okay for them because, you know, this exit, if you can call it that, from Super Rugby means that they can land on their feet and carry on. Obviously, I don't know exactly how those discussions between the Pro 14 and the two franchises went, but it certainly, for the time being, looks like it's going to be a happy ending, and looks like being cut from Super Rugby is not the disaster that we thought it would be for those two franchises.
Yeah, it was interesting talking to Cheetahs coach Rory Duncan yesterday at the Pro 14 launch, where he said that he actually picked up the phone himself to the Pro, as it was, Pro 12 CEO Martin and I, to sort of, hi, lads, we're getting cut. Have your room. Pat, you were there for that time, and it was interesting to hear that perspective.
Yeah, and I know the boys seem kind of in twos with it as well, and but yeah, that was always the thing, wasn't it, with Super Rugby? They kind of diluted the product a little bit, and you know, there was no real rivalries there, and you kind of saw it suffered as a consequence. But no, the lads kind of seemed just kind of chuffed to be there. Everybody's kind of taken it as, let's see what happens, you know, like, let's it's I think even Gerald Davis was saying that at the launch. He was just saying, we know it's a risk. You know, there's a bit of a fear factor there, but let's give it a shot and see what happens. Like, otherwise, those, you know, teams would have just went off into the long dark night. So, like, let's see how they get on. Let's get a few internationals back on. It'll probably be a tough season for them because they're coming off of, what is it, a 6 or 7 week break from the Super Rugby season. So it's going to be a slog for them. But yeah, let's see how they get on. And then I thought the other thing that was interesting from talking to Martin and I from the Pro 14 was just saying that maybe if they start doing well in this competition in a couple of years, that Champions Cup spaces might actually be up for grabs as well, which I thought was an interesting thing.
Whole different ball game.
Lloyd, Kevin here. Just a quick question for me. One of the things you said there is that it was tough on them, as in for the Cheetahs and Kings, it was tough for them to have to make the move. Interestingly enough, I work with Kitman Labs and we work with the Sharks, obviously down in South Africa, in Natal. And I was chatting to their backroom staff when all of this was happening. And one of the bits of feedback, or one of the things they were saying to us, is firstly that they were almost envious of the Cheetahs and the Kings, and that they felt that there would be other South African franchises following them north. And the reasons they were jealous were A, because of the time zone, and B, like the travel. And then other factors, like the fact that they think that the Northern Hemisphere leagues are more organised, more structured, and there's more of a future to them, particularly financially. So I'd just be interested to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the appeal's obvious, you know, like you mentioned the time zones and the potential commercial appeal, which I guess this year will reveal a bit more of just how commercially beneficial it will be. But look, I do think that Super Rugby and playing against the Kiwi teams is still the benchmark. And I do think that from a playing perspective, you want to keep that. You know, with all respect to, we don't know what the competition is going to be like in the Northern Hemisphere. But certainly, I mean, playing against the Kiwi teams week in, week out has to be the benchmark in terms of club rugby and franchise rugby. So the potential for future franchises moving is certainly there. It doesn't even have to be franchises, though. I mean, who's to say that one of our Currie Cup sides can't? You know, we've got Griekwas who are not involved in Super Rugby at the moment, but they're a strong union in the Currie Cup and doing good things this year. Who's to say that in a year's time or two, if this goes well, they can't secure a move? I mean, it all depends how this year goes, I would imagine. Obviously, Martin at the South African launch as well, saying certainly open to future growth and future, you know, talking about going into the States and, you know, the door really seems open. And like you say, at this stage, it seems to be anything goes. You know, the possibilities are endless. And who's to say, you know, who's going to go in the future? I don't know. But I mean, I just can't see, you know, South Africa turning its back on Sanzo and Super Rugby. I mean, it still remains the benchmark in terms of playing, surely.
So we got two new teams joining the league, and for fans out there, what should they expect to see from the Cheetahs and the Southern Kings when they pitch up here? I think the Ulster against Cheetahs, first game of the weekend. That's what will fans expect to see?
Well, it's going to be exciting, and I mean, you know, both of those teams in Super Rugby over the past couple of seasons have been exciting teams to watch. I mean, the Kings this year scored some fantastic tries, you know, attacking from all over the field, and the Cheetahs have sort of been doing that for the last few seasons and trying to play that way. Obviously, from the South African team side, I think conditions are going to play a big part. I think that's the one thing that stands out. You know, I mean, that old traditional Northern Hemisphere style of rugby, it's difficult to imagine the Cheetahs, given what they've been doing in Super Rugby for the past few seasons, trying to implement a game like that, you know. So I think they'll have a go. I think both sides will have a go if it's on. They're not going to be afraid to attack from anywhere. But I think they'll also have to be perhaps a little bit more patient and at some stages a little bit more intelligent than they perhaps needed to be in Super Rugby, playing in the kind of dry, warm conditions that they've been used to.
Yeah, that's going to be one for the Pro 14 teams as well, because, sorry, the old Pro 12 teams going down to South Africa in what is summer.
Yeah.
It's going to be quite different. Hard track.
Yeah, I spoke to Kurt Coleman, who's the new Kings fly half. He's joined from Western Province. I spoke to him yesterday, and he, you know, the general consensus is that it's going to be worse for you guys than it is for our guys.
Is there any altitude involved?
Yeah.
Yeah, you would have in Bloom. I mean, PE is obviously on the coast. But I mean, you know, PE and certainly Bloemfontein over January is, you know, you're going to get temperatures up to 35 degrees, depending on what time you play.
No, I'd be melting in that with my scrum cap on. Yeah.
Whereas the South African guys who played Super Rugby, you know, are still exposed to cold conditions when they play those night games in New Zealand. You know, it's single digits and low single digits, so you would expect the South African teams to be at an advantage in that regard, I would think.
Yeah, I think that wet and cold experience is going to be useful for them.
Yeah, we might not have that kind of Kiwi skill, but we have the single digit weather anyway.
To everything else. Yeah. The rugby championship has also started, and that was a hell of a start last weekend. The All Blacks demolished Australia. That second half didn't matter. The first half was extraordinary. From your perspective, Lloyd, South African start.
Yeah, I thought the All Blacks were going to get to 100 points at one stage there, so it was quite scary for a South African looking on. But yeah, I mean, I think South Africa can be encouraged. I think the Springboks were solid enough, you know, in getting past the Pumas. Obviously, a bit to work on still, I think. I still think against the All Blacks, we're still about 15 points, 20 points short on a good day at this stage. But I think what's key for the Springboks is the next, you know, certainly 2 weeks, or two fixtures at least. I mean, they absolutely have to win in Argentina this weekend, and they absolutely have to win in Australia. Those are two. Alistair, in his 16 tests now, has never won a test away from home. He's 8 from 16, and all 8 of those wins have come at home. And yeah, it's absolutely crucial that they go to Salta this weekend and get a result. I mean, geez, compared to this time last year and compared to the year they had last year, they are certainly promising signs at the moment. And gee, I went 4 from 4 in 2017. If you'd told a South African fan that we were going to be 4 from 4, you know, midway through last year, I don't think they would have believed you. But that being said, it's been all at home against France and Argentina. So I think the real tests this year, and the real tests of how much this team has improved, are still to come. I mean, I think if South Africa can leave the championship with 4 wins from 6, beating Argentina twice, beating Australia twice, and running New Zealand close in Cape Town, I think they can leave the tournament relatively satisfied.
Quickly before we wrap up, on Rassie Erasmus, there's obviously a huge amount of interest here with his exit timetable from Munster, but from your South African perspective, do you expect him down there before December?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I saw those quotes yesterday with everyone else. He seems ready to go. I guess he doesn't want to mess you guys around anymore. So, look, I mean, I guess, you know, the role's from next year, but I don't think it would make too much difference if he came a bit earlier. I think what's more interesting is the exact role that he's going to play once here. You know, Alistair's just starting to find his feet, it seems. He's getting a lot more confidence in the way that he picks his teams and the way that he addresses media. He's just starting to settle into the role and find his feet. So, you know, introducing a man who will effectively be his boss from next season is interesting, and it's a dynamic that we certainly aren't used to in South African rugby with our national team. Now hopefully Rassie comes in and, you know, he's obviously one of the most respected rugby minds in the country, and SA Rugby have wanted him for a long time. I mean, they never wanted him to leave in the first place. And ever since he has left, they've wanted him back. We've almost created a role for him. He's going to come in and take care of our national teams and our structures from top to bottom. So, you know, it looks like it's going to be a more off-field role. Certainly geared at aligning all of the national teams and the franchises and getting everybody on the same page and kind of, I guess, identifying and working on a Springbok and a South African philosophy. So hopefully it won't it won't change what Alistair's doing too much, and Rossi won't be treading on any toes when he gets here. But I mean, certainly exciting times coming up. Yeah.
What's interesting though is a very similar dynamic when Rossi Erasmus came into Munster, where Anthony Foley was head coach, and he came in, and suddenly he was reporting into Rossi, and Rossi did an incredible job there in terms of, you know, working with Axel, and you know, they began to build something special together, and obviously very unfortunately we lost Axel last year. But I think he seems to have those softer skills and the softer management skills and ability to bring people together and work with people, and hopefully he can repeat the same when he goes down to South Africa.
Yeah, well, I think after last season everyone will wish Rossi well, whatever happens. But again, you go to take your national job, I think that's okay with most people too. Thanks to Lloyd from Lloyd Bernard from Sport 24. We'll have fan questions and tips for the weekend's rugby on the way. You're listening to the Hard Yards Rugby Podcast on Sports Joe. Thanks for listening today. We have Hayley O'Connor from Ladbrokes at the table, and our producer Joe Harrington has joined us.
Hey guys, how are you?
Joe, why are you here?
I'm here because for our section with Hayley this year, we wanted to change it up, because if you're listening, you don't know what goes on behind the scenes here. Andy and Pat are really fighting before every podcast about who knows more about rugby. So we wanted to test it out by doing a Pat and Andy head-to-head
for this season. They have to put their money where their mouth is.
Exactly, yeah. So Hayley, we're going to go through four possible options for this week. Going forward, we'll do all the Pro 14 games and stuff like that. But this week, let's start with the Women's Rugby World Cup final. What do Ladbrokes have on that?
Well, there's no surprises in terms of who's turning up for the final. So the England New Zealand final was expected. England are 13-8 on, and New Zealand 11-8. And I suppose in a way it would kind of be nice to see New Zealand win, because like England are the only pro team in the tournament, and
it's England.
And it's England, exactly. So obviously it's kind of sad to see Ireland crash out, and a lot of the criticism has sort of come under their coaches, and you just think how annoyed you'd be if you put in so much dedication for like a non-professional sport and then to have it messed up by the people who are supposed to be leading you. And you know, they were criticised strategically and technically, and then Eddie O'Sullivan saying they were running around with their hair on fire. But anyway, if you want to back the handicap, England -3 can be backed at 10-11, and New Zealand +3 at 10-11. So what do you fancy?
I'm taking New Zealand, and I'm taking them because when I was down there, there was an amazing little piece at halftime of the Japan-Australia game, where the Japanese little cheer section, all the kids were out there with drums and flags, and the adults behind them with bigger drums. And some of the Black Ferns who'd just finished their game came over and were taking selfies or whatever, and then joined in. So they were banging the drums. It was brilliant. And so that's why they get my vote.
It's an emotional vote that you've made.
Completely emotional.
Not exactly tactical analysis from Andy.
This is not a hardcore stats bet.
That's handy to kind of kick off, because I'm going to go for England on this one, because I've seen them actually a couple of times in the flesh there out at UCD, and really impressed with them. So yeah, I'm happy enough that we've actually clashed here in our first one. It'd be very boring if we all picked the exact same here. Yeah.
Next games we want to talk about, guys, our Rugby Championship. We spoke to Lloyd Bernard about it. How do you think it's going to go?
Well, in terms of a betting prospect, the New Zealand-Australia is kind of a non-event. It's going to be very, very quiet for us. 66-1 on New Zealand, and we kind of think that they can win as much as they want. And if you want to back them -29, you can have them at even money. But I think we're not going to be taking them on, and it's very you couldn't give Australia away even
66-1.
66-1 on, and 20-1 for Australia. Yeah, your turn.
Well,
go on, surprise us.
Yeah, we were talking about this. We're just saying New Zealand could have somebody sent off or something. There could be something like that. Or
had a bit of a fiasco last, didn't they? Their last game with their flanker sent off, so not making it due to some sex scandal.
Yeah, Kano. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry. I think the term is personal issue.
But then that's it. Yeah, even more motivation.
Will Sonny Bill be playing? Remember they picked up that HIA that wasn't The HIA, that wasn't, is actually the term.
Yeah.
It was floating around like Bambi on ice.
Yeah, again, it's like, did they have someone to watch that? Like, you know, like, and his legs were gone, like, for a couple of, not a couple of minutes, but around 10 seconds, and then...
He took a couple of hits in that few seconds as well.
Like. Yeah, I think he might have even got back in the line and made another hit, but...
Right, stop stalling.
This is pure stalling. Like, I'm definitely going with New Zealand here, and you're not allowed.
Are you backing them? Are you going for New Zealand minus 29, though, right?
Yeah, I'll do that.
No, I'm absolutely backing New Zealand.
Okay.
But I do think, genuinely, when you see a two-horse race go out when one side is 20-1, I'm putting my money where my mouth is, and I'm sticking a fiver on that.
Argentina, South Africa.
Yeah, so Argentina might play a bit better being at home. So they're 9-4 and South Africa 4-11. And it's kind of maybe a little bit exciting how well South Africa played in their last match. I think they had a 4-try victory. And like, for lots of reasons, you'd love to see South Africa get back to the former glory that they once were for World Rugby. In the handicap, Argentina +7 can be backed at even money, and South Africa -7 can be backked at evens. And actually the draw -7 is 25-1. So,
Andy, how do you feel about that?
I always like seeing Argentina do well, but no, I have to go with South Africa in this one. South Africa to win.
Yes, I was going to say the same. Can we spice it up a little bit more, or we just go South Africa, we'll just go winner?
No, just go win.
A short price winner is better than a big price loser.
All right, South Africa. But my Pro 14 winner is going to absolutely shock you.
Okay, great.
How type it is.
That leads us on nicely to the Pro 14. Who's favourite and who's close?
Well, like, unsurprisingly, we really can't look beyond Leinster. So they're our favourites at 7-4, Munster 4-1. We did lose a bit of money last season opposing Munster, but they have that cloud of wondering who's going to replace Razzy Erasmus. The two new teams, the Cheetahs are 14-1, the Kings are 25-1. And, you know, the only kind of question marks that are coming up about Leinster are, you know, Leo Cullen's already sort of blowing about his away matches over in South Africa. He doesn't have the training format of where he can train. So, and also, I think they can only bring a total team of 40 over, which is actually probably quite small when you take into account medics and everything. So, and that's going to be a learning curve. But I suppose with Leinster signing like James Lowe, Scott Fardy, like, they're going to be unstoppable.
Yeah, guys, I'm interested. I'm going to go to Pat first because you teased that really well. Who do you think is going to win the Pro 14?
I'm good that I got to go first. I'm going to go Leinster. I was going to think of something risky, but to go Leinster.
Yeah. Really put your neck on the line there. Yeah.
I think the whole thing is I went first, and then Andy doesn't get that pick as well. I think that's how we should do this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. I don't want to go with Leinster. I don't know.
Like, Munster have a lot of changes. This, like, you know, they're going to have a new coach in the middle, and they could have like Felix Jones, something like that, could just be their interim coach for the end of the season.
At least he's part of the setup, though.
Yeah,
that might be less of an upheaval. I mean, that's what I was thinking of. I don't think Scarlett's can do it again.
Like, they brought Halfpenny in, which is brilliant, but then they lost Liam Williams as well. So, and then can they win two in a row?
Two in a row is
maybe
really,
I should be
really
trying
tough.
To talk you into something. I don't know.
You
Scarlett's,
should be, yeah.
Yeah, Scarlett's are the team to go for, I'd say.
No, I'm going to lean towards Munster again.
Great stuff. So the plan is to keep track of this, and maybe at Christmas time we can review to see who knows more about rugby.
To be very particular, you're keeping track of it.
Yes, I am keeping track of it. Yeah, I'm keeping mental notes in my head here. Yeah. So yeah, we'll see how it unfolds. But up next, we have listener questions for Rog, Ian, and Kev.
Rog, Ian, and Kev are back in to answer your fan questions. We put a call out yesterday, and these are the best ones we got in on Twitter. So, for future shows, use the hashtag AskTHY on Twitter if you want to ask a question for next week. The first one in is from Colin Munfan. Which of the off-season signings will make the biggest impact on his province? Kev.
So
we haven't shown these to you.
That is an extremely good question. I'm racking my brain trying to think here. I think someone like Scott Fardy coming to Leinster is kind of a big impact. He's still playing great rugby for Australia. He's really experienced.
And I think as much as what he'll add on the pitch, he'll also bring a great deal of learning for some of the younger players, back rowers and second rowers in the squad. Whether you're playing the second row or the back row is yet to be seen. I saw they
Cullen
put him
seems,
out.
Yeah, he's insisted that it's going to be second row.
Yeah, I looked Leo straight in the eye at the launch. Said, he's a lock, yeah. And he looked me back. He's a lock.
Yeah, he played in the second row in the game on Friday against Gloucester.
Well, he has to, because with the contract rules, if they mess around, you know, everyone's going to see it.
Yeah, no, I've always been a big admirer of him, though. He's very, very tough and always performs. I think he'd be really good for Leinster.
Yeah. Straight to the next one. Right, from Killian Byrne. Do the panel think that the uncertainty and messing around with the Pro 12, his view, hasten the arrival of an Irish-English-French Super League? Rog, what do you reckon? Is this something which you'd ever think we'll see?
An Irish-English-French Super League?
Yeah.
Just needs a snazzy
title. Not at the minute, no. When you're outside Ireland, I think it's very, as we can see, when it comes to the rights and what happens in Europe in rugby, they have a small say. I think the two power superpowers are France and England, so whatever they do, they'll have the ultimate say. I feel it would be fantastic to have it, but you know, I mean, the reality of it is that there's a real league, not a real league, but a league in France and a league in England with relegation. The Pro 14 is a competition where there's no relegation, so the pressures are absolutely nowhere near the same. It's in those countries, it's preparation for the national team. There's a massive amount of pride and value coming into winning that in the last 3 or 4 years, perhaps, but for the last 20 years in Ireland, you're judged on whether you win the Champions Cup, the European Cup, and how you do with your national team. The Pro 14 is finding its legs, but I think it becomes devalued when there isn't relegation. It's different pressure, you know. It's a very, very, very different competition. And I've only witnessed that since you see what it does to areas in France that become relegated. The whole area, town, suffers incredibly poorly as a result of their team going down.
Next question. From Colin Mahan.
Sorry, that was a cold answer. Silence.
Thanks for cheering us up there, Roger.
Yeah,
I'm okay with that. I want an honest answer. I'm completely okay with that. Next question for Ian. You can feel this one, or at least start the ball rolling. From Colin Mahan, who is the most exciting uncapped player in Irish rugby?
Good question.
It is good. We were going home as well. Yeah, there are, especially when they're
name
just after a summer tour.
Uncapped players for us, please.
Yeah,
Pat, you help us out here. Who's
no Pat? Pat got a cap on the summer tour.
Billy Jardis was a guy who was familiar with in the Leinster Academy. He's on the seventh circuit now. He's you know, incredible footwork, good speed, good strength. He's someone who's, you know, definitely has the potential of playing for Ireland.
What about this Jordan Lamore guy? Was he schools when you were there, Ian, or had you seen much of him, Kev? The new Leinster back.
Yeah, someone played the 20s last year. He's a very good player as well.
Yeah, he's savage.
The guy I would suggest for this season, I think that may make the breakthrough, would be Ronan O'Mahony. I think his age profile is probably over 25, but I think in terms of one to watch of the uncapped brigade, I would definitely put him forward. I think he can offer something gearing towards the World Cup. It's an incredibly competitive area, the back three for Ireland, but I watch out for him big time.
And finally, I have to ask this. Right, will everyone be watching Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor? Yes, that is a yes from Roger's house.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's a yes from me and yes from Rog. Kev?
No, I'll be in land or not. Not a hope I'm getting up for it.
No, I'll be watching it. I'll be watching it, Rog.
Yeah,
texting Pat Lamb at 5 a.m. to see what he makes of it.
Oh yeah, well done the work ethic
on WhatsApp.
No, that's good. Listen, guys, we'll let you go, I think. Thanks to Rog, to Ian, to Kev, to Pat, and Hayley O'Connor. Joe Harrington for producing, and Shane Dempsey was on sound. We'll be back next Thursday with a new podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes, Podcast Republic, SoundCloud, and every good podcast app to get it straight to your phone. This has been The Hard Yards. I'm Andy McGeady. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Ladbrokes. Passionate about sport.